And here I have Ken, and he is going to present us in the last talk of Earth and Science session. He's going to talk about God's voice in geology. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you very much. As I was listening to Greg at the first part of this session, I'm thinking, wow, it would have been interesting if it had happened that there was his and mine right behind it because of the dramatic parallelism, but that's not the way it was scheduled, so we have that a little time break with some other things about geology and the Ogallala Aquifer as some related examples. In my devotional this morning, I did make some discussions about the plates moving, and traditionally I often show the plates moving at the end of a talk. And the other day, as Helen and I were talking, we thought, well, I should do it at the beginning of the talk this time. Now I got to get up, get my mouse over on the other spot there, which I'm not accustomed to doing here. All right, we're going to pull that out so it gets to where it's supposed to be and bring it up that way and then get it back together.
I think it's under view where you were.
Well, it may be, but the map... With my mouse, it doesn't automatically come up on the other screen, is what was happening. So, there we go. Okay, I'm going to let it play right there. Timing-wise, this is 170 million years ago when this starts, about the beginning in the Jurassic. And now you can see the Indian subcontinent moving rather quickly up across the area and crashing into Asia. So there is the geological and God-engineered design that has built the Himalaya Mountains. And I'm going to play it at least once more. You'll see that first the North Atlantic opens, and then after a period of time the South Atlantic opens, and then India starts north and crashes in. The hit against Asia is about 20 million years ago. So basically, these continents, the Indian subcontinent crashing into Asia, is the step that triggers the formation of the Himalaya Mountains. And we had that earthquake just some months ago in Nepal that's a sequel to that process. Now we'll come out. Oh, there, I'm up there. That's good. That's good. I'm done with this now. And that's good. Now come back to PowerPoint. At least it's on the right scale, and I can get back up there. PowerPoint, I'm there. Okay, that should come up right. All right. Now, crashing into Asia like that, here I have a slide with three panels. The first panel is, say, India is still 50 million years ago. India is still far south. Then here in the middle panel, I'm showing 30 million years ago, and right there on the south side of Asia, we're now showing some evidence of marine fossils and marine sediments because this is the coastline of the southern portion of Asia. So there is the marine sediments. And by the time then that India has crashed into Asia, you can see that those marine sediments are up on top of and high up on the Himalaya Mountains. Our children are hearing over and over again that the fossils and the marine sediments are up, the fossils are up on Mount Everest and the Himalaya Mountains because Noah's flood put them up there 4,300 years ago. Here is a much more credible description of that sequence. Greg showed you one slide of this. Greg and I always appreciate when we see things in Scripture that connect with geology. Or speak to the earth and it will teach you, and let the fish of the sea, they will inform you. Job 12:8. He says to the snow, fall on the earth. And as Greg so nicely pointed out, this is present tense verse. Okay, present tense in what God is describing. So he's continually active in his creation. As I quoted this morning from Johannes Kepler, the chief aim of all investigations of the external world should be to discover the rational order and harmony which has been imposed on it by God. And that's what we so enjoy studying. I made the comment about a book called The Privileged Planet by Guillermo Gonzalez and J. Richard. Richard's published about 10 years ago now. And he's Gonzalez is an astronomer, so a lot of the book has astronomy components, but they have a couple of chapters about geology, which are very powerful, and I'll be showing you some of the comments and things that they made comment about the geology portions. They describe the universe as being very fine-tuned for the Earth, and they build that carefully and very well. And it is fine-tuned that we have life here on Earth. And it is very fine-tuned and in a situation and a location for discovery. So my theme now for the rest of the talk is part of that discovery. In my abstract, I put a note that there were six times that "and God said" in Genesis 1. And Steve Huffy correctly pointed out that there are actually eight in there, but it's representing by the six time periods that are referenced as the days. "Let the water under the sky be gathered into one place, and let dry ground appear," and it was so. And Greg showed some slides in the first part of the talk here about that component, and I'll bring wording to that in terms of timing. A record that we have of understanding the early parts of the Earth suggests microcontinents showed up about 3.5 billion years ago, and then the process of plate tectonics that had full motion with the plates moving and mountain building processes about 2.5 billion years ago. Then, two other verses of the "and God said." Verse 20, "Let the water teem with living creatures," bringing in the biology. And verse 24, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds." And ultimately, as Greg so nicely said and poignantly said, God is an artist and he paints different views of the biosphere over geologic timescale. So here's the reference to the Cambrian explosion, when we had a rapid expansion of the various families that we see as God created them that are in the biosphere today. The early part of the Earth here in what geologists refer as the Paleozoic, which you can see that word on the time card that I handed out, is basically plant life and lower animal life. Then in the Cenozoic, or the Mesozoic, is the period of the dinosaurs. And then the more recent one, Cenozoic, is the period of the mammals. And then in this slide, connected more closely with the geologic timescale that I have in the card, we have these notes: the Cambrian explosion reference, the age of the dinosaurs, and the age of the mammals. Now, Terry, as you're aware, is going to get PDFs of these files. And in fact, the PDF that I give to him will have even a few more slides in here that are mixed in that I have put on hide mode momentarily for this sequence. So there'll be more slides on that presentation than I'm showing you here right now for the sake of time to get through the themes that I want to present. One of those themes is oil and gas in the ground that we have available that has made our modern society possible. And because my world has been petroleum geology for the last 30 years, it's appropriate that I give a bit of perspective of that. All those phytoplankton and zooplankton that have been living in ocean waters over geologic timescales of the Paleozoic are heavily trapped in black shales that we refer to as source rocks. That is, they're the source of the organic matter that eventually has gotten into the oil and gas. Then we find oil and gas in what we call reservoir rocks. And the reservoir rocks are rocks that have holes in them in which the oil and gas can sit. And on top is going to be a seal rock or a trap rock that prevents that oil and gas from escaping out to the surface. All right? Now, I don't have time to show the modern unconventional environment that has exploded in the last 5 years that you've heard about with respect to fracking and earthquakes in Oklahoma. That was the talk that I gave yesterday to the geological field trip. So if any of you want it privately, I'd be willing to do so, sketchy, because the file is on the computer. But the point is, all this oil that we find in the ground, God designed and engineered over geologic timescales, so it's available, or we would not have the nature of our society and culture today. Here are the countries that have the big amounts. Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Canada, the rest of the Middle Eastern countries, and from there on it goes down to lesser amounts of oil and gas. So just a reference. The Canadian one, of course, is most friendly to us if we will. And 10 years ago when I built this slide, Canada was way down there. It wasn't even on this slide at that time. But what has happened in the last 7 or 8 years is that the oil industry in Canada has been able to develop what are referred to as the Athabasca oil sands around Fort McMurray that has an absolutely enormous resource that is now brought availability to the marketplace, which now puts Canada up here at number 3. So they jumped up from about number 10 up to number 3 once that resource was proven up to be able to be produced. Now in the Privileged Planet, Gonzalez and Richards very nicely said and gave examples the way God has engineered his creation, that there are data recorders that give us the opportunity to decipher Earth's history on what God has done with his providence through geologic timescales. These include things like ice cores. They include the fact that tree rings grow annually as the growth of a tree, so we can use tree ring cycles. Sedimentary vars are a type of sediment that I will describe to you in a moment. Corals grow with some banding that give us the passage of time. And this word spilothems is the geologic term to apply to cave deposits that have layers in them that can be deciphered. First, ice cores. And in a previous session this morning, Keith Miller talked about some of the melting off of the ice from Greenland and Antarctica. Well, I'll show here in the next slide, Greenland. This slide is of a mountain in South America that has a snow-capped peak that was on that slide a little bit ago. And here is 25,000 years of a record in the ice of oxygen that gives us the opportunity to use a proxy to understand temperature, such that this demonstrates that we have had about 11,000 years of basically nice climate with warm temperatures compared to prior to that time when the Earth was still in the last glacial period or the last ice age. The ice core record in Greenland ice core is about the same in terms of the timing. So there's the 11,000 years from the last ice age here to our modern period of 11,000 years where we've had basically pretty nice climate. And the ice sheets that came down across North America to about Chicago and New York and were on the Scandinavian Peninsula have melted away. I will point out to you that notice in the last ice age, there were time periods where there were very rapid warm-ups. So to here, and there's quite a rapid warm-up. So interestingly, God has the ice age cycles engineered such that there can be fairly rapid warm-up and differences of glacial to interglacial periods. And there's a photograph of ice cores to give you a perspective. The light and dark layers can be counted to demonstrate the difference between the snow falling in the wintertime And then in the summertime, as the sun shines on the surface of that ice and snow, it has a different chemical composition because of some of the chemical species that fall in the ice, so they can see layering like this. For us here in the U.S., this ice core is physically up in Denver at the U.S. Geological Survey location. We can use tree rings to get a passage of time, and geologists have found that they can tie in a dead tree to a living tree. So here's a tree ring series of a living tree. Here's a tree ring series of a tree trunk that was gotten out of a cabin. And there are wet and dry cycles here in terms of wide tree rings and narrow tree rings that can be matched to identify that this portion of this tree lived in the same group of years that that portion of the living tree. This is referred to as cross-dating, so that can be taken back in time with successive series of tree rings. Sedimentary varves are annual layers. Think about a lake that is in frozen country like Minnesota, and in the wintertime, of course, there's ice on the surface. So the wintertime sediment is fine-grained, dark clay and mud. When it warms up in the summertime, then algae that live in the surface water fall to the bottom and make a light layer. So we get alternating light and dark layers from summer-winter cycles. And this is the couplet that geologists have referred to as varves. So fine sediment in the wintertime, coarse sediment in the summertime makes a pair there that we call varves. Radioactive atoms are part of the counting system that we have the opportunity to look at the passage of time. And one very common is radiocarbon that you've heard about with respect to biblical archaeology. So, with radiocarbon and with tree rings, we can get a perspective of when things happened during biblical timescales. The horizontal axis is physically counting the tree rings. The vertical axis is the measured amount of radiocarbon in those successive tree rings, so that when a tree branch has been found in Hezekiah's tunnel, and it has that amount of radiocarbon, we can bring that data point up to the horizontal axis and observe that that piece of tree trunk or tree branch lived about 2,700 years ago or 700 years BC. Similar measurements have been done with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and Dead Sea Scrolls demonstrated to about 2,100 years ago, or just a little bit before Christ. The overall record for radiocarbon is suitable back to about 45,000 years, by which time the amount of radiocarbon in there has decreased down to such a low level that it's not measurable with credibility, with reliable measurements of going back farther than that. The most dramatic tools that we have been given by God because of radioactive atoms, I refer to as clocks in the rocks. And these are long half-life radioactive atoms. And one example is uranium that gets taken up into the mineral zircon. And a step that is necessary to establish the start of this clock, or I call them timers, is that the liquid magma that was in the volcano squirts up out of the subsurface and crystallizes down to a solid piece of rock, which sets the timer to zero. And then as the radioactive decay continues to take place, we can use a measure if we go out and get that rock today and by establishing the criteria for a credible date, be able to give a context of how many years in the past that rock changed from a liquid to a solid. And geologists have done that to get the context of the age of the Earth. Meteorites are pieces of rock from in our solar system that have fallen on the Earth, and we've measured those by a number of different methods. The first there, representing the uranium method, gives 4.55 billion years. Another radioactive atom, rubidium, gives about a 4.5. A radioactive atom of potassium gives 4.5. A radioactive atom of rhenium gives 4.6. And ultimately, the age of the Earth was deciphered in about the mid-1950s to be about 4.56 billion years. And that's where those kinds of contexts come from. Now, I showed you the animation of the plates moving. And in the Pacific, we have a series of the Hawaiian Islands that you know about, but also to the northwest, there are submarine mountains. And even beyond the submarine mountains that are in line with the Hawaiian island chain, there are also a series of submarine mountains that we call the Emperor Seamount chains. And as the Pacific plate moved over a hot spot over about 80 million years, the liquid magma came up, squirted through the crust, and built an island. And as the plate kept moving on to the north, successive islands were constructed as the plate moved, such that when we go out and we get an oceanographic research vessel and we dredge up some of the igneous rocks from that process, we observe increasing age from 2 million years to 28 million years to 80 million years of the ages of those rocks. And we have a distance, so we have a rate at which that plate was moving, averaging about 3.2 inches per year, and the northern portion a little bit less at 2.6 inches per year. We can physically measure the rate at which that plate is moving today by satellite technology, and it's about 3.1 inches per year. So for us as geologists and geochemists, we feel we have a pretty neat tool to be able to compare and affirm the reliability of these radiometric dating methods because we've observed the plate moving and we've confirmed it with similar measurements today. There's a description of the plates, and this is the map that Greg showed that shows a lot of the earthquakes that have occurred at plate boundaries. This process from the subsurface down in the crust and below the crust in the mantle is that there are large convection cells of semi-liquid rock, so that as those plates spread apart in the South Atlantic, as I showed in the animation, gradually igneous rock comes up and it forms new ocean crust at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Now, the Earth's magnetic field has changed polarity a number of times, actually many times, over geologic time scales, so that when the Earth's polarity was normal, the rocks that are formed at the mid-ridge will demonstrate that the polarity was normal. At times in the past, when the polarity of the Earth's magnetic field was reversed, the opposite direction, that is, the compass would point to the south instead of a north, then there's a band of rocks that are reverse polarity. And further back in time, they'll be successively normal, reversed, normal, reversed. So basically, God has given us a magnetic data recorder to observe the spreading of the Atlantic Ocean basin. So successively, the pattern on this side follows the same pattern on that side, and we get a chronology of the separation. One of the points that Gonzalez and Richards made was that if these plates, if the oceanic crust, instead of being rather thin at about 2-3 miles, if it were, say, tens of miles thick, we would not be able to measure that magnetic field and see those differences, those alternations back and forth. So, dramatic example. Just 2 or 3 more slides and then questions. As Greg said, we have Solid Rock Lectures seek to bring science material to seminaries under the banner here, the name of Solid Rock Lectures. And seminary professors have affirmed to us that this is important for the sake of the church these days. And we've done that. In this case, this is an example of sample title talks that we had at a workshop that we did here at our own church in Tulsa, at Kirk of the Hills, over on 61st Street. The other thing that we're coming to with just within months is that about 10 years ago, God inspired a geologist in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to desperately want a book published about the Grand Canyon. And this is finally coming to fruition, so a group of us, 11 of us, have written a book called The Grand Canyon, Monument to an Ancient Earth. Can Noah's Flood Explain the Grand Canyon? Now, we had the privilege that your association, the ASA, had some funding for a book project 10 to 12 years ago that ended up not being completed. And Steve Moser, who's one of the key authors on this, is on the executive committee now. And that came up as a line item that there was some funds sitting in the ASA reserve or wherever it be identified, but that funding was not used yet for the book. So Steve talked to Randy at the next break, and he said, we're doing this book on the Grand Canyon. Could that funding possibly fit this book? They went back into the executive committee, and Steve described the book and the details, and they said yes, and they approved it. So we have some funding for this from the ASA to get it printed. And just about 2 weeks ago, I got an affirmation from Kriegel Publishing in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that they want to work with us to publish this book. So when Randy and colleagues with ASA put a bulletin out on the website in whatever it's going to take, 6 to 9 months or a year, I don't know how long it'll take yet, this is it, and you can get it. So, any questions?
Thank you so much.
Yep. Yes, please.
Please. I'm embarrassed to ask the question because it means I haven't done my homework.
That's okay.
I'm related too.
Yep.
I keep hearing younger people refer to this Mount St. Helens.
Yes.
And so on, and I'd like to hear a little bit about that story. And the other question, follow up, is why don't they accept your story?
Yep. They don't accept our story because they have made a presupposition that their interpretation of Genesis is the only one that's acceptable to be faithful to Scripture, so the earth is already 6,000 years old. So as one of the other speakers, either this afternoon or this morning, said, when science is trapped or when anybody's trapped in a presuppositional lockdown, they cannot see the rest of the data. And that's what we're observing there. The Mount St. Helens is one of the most saddest stories that I have ever heard spread in the church, because the dominant mode is, they say, it was an explosive event and sediments were deposited, and they stand there and say, geologists claim that all sediments were deposited over millions of years, and that is misleading because geology is analogous to a soldier's life. There are long periods of slow boredom. So right now the Mississippi River is slowly carrying some sediment to the Gulf of Mexico every day. Then there are short periods of absolute terror. Okay? And Mount St. Helens was a short period of 2 or 3 days that dumped out enormous volumes of ash that built up 30 feet, 50 feet of sediment in minutes or days. When the asteroid hit the Yucatan Peninsula 65 million years ago, that was a catastrophic event that is one of the factors that geologists consider for the demise of the dinosaurs because of the incredible impact. That was a real bell ringer in terms of the Earth. The worst part about Mount St. Helens is that a geologist went and collected samples of the rocks. He had them done by potassium argon, sent them to the lab. From his knowledge, he should have known, and he almost certainly knew and expected that he would get old ages, because the rocks that came up, the timer was not set to zero. And I have observed a speaker from that organization walk across the stage like this at a church here in Oklahoma and say, those rocks were dated at 2 million years. It does not take rocket science to know that radiometric dating does not work. And that is the message that goes out to church after church after church. And I was recently teaching a class to a seminary in California, and the speaker, the young earth speaker from that organization, never showed that group of 5 examples with uniform dates from different isotopes. He said, I am here to demonstrate to you that radiometric dating does not work. And that gentleman has a PhD in geochemistry. Enough said. Now, I've said this kind of quickly, and be glad to elaborate, because it's real fast. Yes, John?
Well, Ken, I've heard excellent talk. Again, I've heard other times when you've shared where you started off, maybe you said it and I didn't hear it, that you believe all Scripture is inspired by God. You take it literally.
I believe absolutely that the Bible is true, it's authoritative, it's inerrant, and it is infallible. And there are numbers of Bible scholars repeatedly that said faithful, inerrant scripture does not require that the earth is young. Walt Kaiser, Norm Geisler, go on and on and on. There are some that say it has to be a young earth. But ultimately, the young earth description of the earth, instead of a description, Scripture says that God is not a God of confusion. Examining the young earth presentation of God's creation is a comedy of confusion. Please don't record that one. Or clip that one out, probably. As you can tell, I can remain calm most of the time, but at other times, I know I lose it because inside I'm boiling when I hear of Mount St. Helens, which I heard again about 3 days ago in church somewhere. Other questions, or I think it's, we really should break for the break.
We have half hour for break, but if you have any question and you want to talk with
Absolutely. Thank you very much for listening. Appreciate it.